Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This is a special bonus episode of the program that we broadcast from New York on arbitrations and arbitration clauses with members of the Intermediaries Reinsurance Underwriters Association. You know, we had so many experienced umpires and arbitrators in attendance. And the insights, the questions, some of the back and forth after the initial presentation were so worthwhile and so insightful that we thought it was worth making this bonus episode. Portions of the tape are a little bit difficult to hear, but we think that the insights you'll receive are worth going through. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we go back to some of the questions, answers, and thoughts from our session on arbitrations and arbitration clauses.
Hi, I'm just curious if you've done anything preemptively on cross-border e-discovery. One of the problems we see in litigation is the European Union and some of the Asian countries have data privacy laws. And if you've got a Belgian reinsurer and an American reinsurer in an arbitration, the laws of Belgium will prevent the disclosure of the documents you're looking for. I'm not sure that the litigants can waive it. Is there anything that you put in a clause to level the playing field in one manner or another?
Well, the challenge there is that arbitration panels cannot do anything contrary to public policy. And if that law, in Belgium, for example, happens to be a strict public policy, the panel in the United States may order something, but if that company can't obey that law without incurring the wrath of its own government, chances are that ultimately that order of discovery would be trumped by public policy.
Martin Haber, I think you guys did a great job here in terms of talking about what needs to be drafted and should be agreed upon by the parties. My question has to do with who the parties are. It seems to me the biggest impediment is the broker in this transaction because when you draft the reinsurance agreement, many times the broker takes the heavy oar in that and generally ignores anything that slows down getting the deal done. And everything you're suggesting requires thought and conferences on both sides. How do you convince the broker to do the right thing? Oh, one other point. When I say broker, many times reinsurance agreements are reinsured by more than one market. There's an American market, a European market, an Asian market, etc., which I think further complicates the issue.
As to the first issue, the parties have to make it clear, and this is the point I'm trying to make today, that more thought needs to go into this process. And if it means they have to just come right out and tell the broker, we need a better arbitration provision than that. That's what they have to do. In terms of making the brokers aware of that,
Marty, you're absolutely right. The contracts are driven mostly by business considerations, and a lot of times, no matter what those of us in the room may feel about what happens in a dispute resolution relative to the business transaction, it may not be that important. But what I have seen, for example, is one company will only subscribe to reinsurance treaties if it has a couple of provisions, one relating to confidentiality, and I'm not recalling what the other one is, and they just got the word out to the broker and gave the broker that language, and the broker understands when, if it wants to include that particular reinsurer, it needs this language, and then it makes its way in. And so sometimes by just A, demanding it, or B, depending on your power on the business side to insist upon it, you can get the brokerage community to put those provisions in. But sometimes parties are just happy to agree, get their premium or get their cover and move on and leave the disputes for the rotten lawyers later on. But the other thing I will say is sometimes because of a course of dealings between the parties and prior disputes and things that they've agreed upon in the past or arbitration awards that they've been subject to, they have altered their, by agreement obviously, they've altered the arbitration provisions. And one of the things we didn't talk about today, which is a pet peeve of mine, is reasonable versus unreasonable awards. And in all the years I've been practicing, and don't let my dyed hair fool you, but it's been many, I've not seen a situation where I have ever wanted as a lawyer representing a party to receive an unreasoned award, or had a party that ever wanted an unreasoned award. You know, the main reason is, well, if you give a reasoned award, maybe it's subject to challenge. There is not an arbitrator or umpire worth their weight in salt that cannot do a reasoned award and make it appeal-proof or not subject to vacator. And I have to say that parties that participate in the process, whether it's a quick, relatively inexpensive hearing or it's a long, hard-fought one, appreciate knowing the reasoning of the panel. And obviously the panel would have discretion as to how much of that reasoning it shares, but it's a very unfulfilling thought. It's like when you lose game 7 of a playoff series and you're in there and you're rooting for the home team and it's over and you just go home. It's helpful to the parties, and I think it's helpful to the process and people's confidence in the process to get reasoned awards. So it didn't relate to your question. I thought I would throw it in.
Just to inject some controversy into the discussion, so we don't get too sleepy before we close. Two things with respect to that, as I'm looking across the table to some of my non-lawyer arbitrator friends, I perceive, my perception may be wrong, that there is a distinct difference of view between the non-lawyer arbitrators and the lawyer arbitrators on certain subjects like reasoned awards. For us recovering lawyers, it's writing a reasoned award is fun. It's the closest thing to being a judge, you know, without wearing a black robe that we're ever going to get to do. And it's challenging, and it's, and you want your parties to understand what you did, and you want a potential reviewing court, very importantly, to understand exactly what you did. And to the extent that there have been vacatures at all over the years, I think it's often the case that the court didn't understand what the panel did. That's one controversy, and I'd be interested in what people have to say about it. The other that I'd inject is custom and practice as a standard of review. Again, I may be wrong, but there was a time, I believe, in history when lawyers weren't involved in these arbitrations. There was a panel of 3 underwriters who listened to cases presented by underwriters, and they didn't have anything other than custom and practice as a standard for review. As we all know, in recent years, it's just not true. These cases are lawyered to death. Let me just put it out there just to make it controversial, isn't isn't it time that we abandon custom and practice as a standard altogether in an arbitration clause?
And somebody else just suggested maybe return to custom and practice. And I'll get your take, but one thing I want to, you know, in custom and practice when you're in court is a very high bar. It's, and I just happen to have this here, a party seeking to establish custom and practice in a court proceeding generally bears the burden of proving that the reputed practice is so well settled and uniformly acted upon as to raise a fair presumption that it was known to the contracting parties and that they contracted in reference to it. That's what it generally means to a court. It's a pretty high bar. And so I'd like to throw back at you guys, to panel members, it may mean something different, and maybe either a, you know, just a different standard or a lower bar. But what does it take for something to be a custom and practice?
This gets back to the tradition of using the tripartite panel in reinsurance arbitration, because the underlying assumption was that three persons would have to agree upon what custom and practice is in order to issue an award based on it, as opposed to the understanding of one person. But it's sort of, at the same time, a pig and a poke concept. If the three folks get together and decide this is the custom and practice, it's still limited to just three persons, and three persons by their background. But the reality is that when an award goes up in front of a court and the losing side wants to challenge it, the court is going to assume that the custom and practice is what the panel decided to do. If the arbitration provision said that the award would be determined in accordance with it.
I go back to Ed's very good statement that was up on the board now, etc. Custom and practice is like pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And the problem is, tell me, when is the custom and practice you're talking about? Is it a 1955 rule of the general liability policy that's all risk? Or is it a property policy in 1987 that was renewed 13 times? Number one. Number two, who's custom and practice? If you've reinsured this in Lloyd's versus reinsuring it with General Re, you may have two separate customs and practices, not the same. Both of which may be valid, but who are you arbitrating against? Unless you have real specific definitions, you'll never solve the problem. Either before judge or an arbitrator, you get a person on an arbitration panel who wasn't born when the contract was entered into, how would that person know unless it's in a book somewhere? So I think it's a very difficult question to answer.
Thank you both for all your time and putting together this excellent program. My question is brings us back to discovery, and I think that's one of the biggest problems facing our industry and arbitration, and why it's getting a bad rap lately, because certainly it involves a lot more time, considerable cost. And from the arbitrator perspective, what's happening is we're hearing arbitrators aren't controlling the process and they're not limiting discovery. And yet it's the lawyers who are coming in saying, we want discovery, and they're both agreeing to it, and they want X number of depositions, they want extended discovery going beyond claim files, going beyond underwriting files. And we as arbitrators are kind of scratching our heads, so what should we do if this is the party's process and this is what we want? So I go back to the question about, you know, that you raised, Ed, you know, how specific should arbitration clauses be when, on one hand, you want them to be flexible so they could accommodate different cases, different issues, but Can you say X number of depositions? Can you say only claims and underwriting files? What would you suggest be incorporated in a clause? When you use words such as proportionality, relevance, materiality, we could probably get 30-page briefs from each party as to what that means. So I'm not sure that that would help solve the problem. Having said all that, I guess, again, you know, what more specific solutions can you suggest on this discovery problem?
Here are two provisions in the material of depositions. And one just takes a very straightforward approach. Each party shall be entitled to take no more than 5 depositions, including those of third parties. The second one is a little broader in terms of the flexibility, and it says each party shall be entitled to take no more than 3 depositions, including of those third parties, unless a majority of the panel allows additional depositions upon a finding of good cause. Again, what is good cause, and does give a lot of flexibility to the party, to the panel rather. But these are the same sorts of issues that judges would face, and the judges have the advantage of having the federal rules and the state procedural rules to guide them in how many depositions the parties are entitled to. I think that by including provisions like this in arbitration agreements now, there's a better chance that when the case becomes before the panel will take it seriously, and the panel will say, look, it says no more than 5 depositions unless you show good cause. We haven't seen good cause. We're not giving it to you. It allows the panel, based on the party's intent, to insert control over the process over the objection of one of the party's attorneys who is trying to turn it into a 3-ring circus.
And the problem with dealing with discovery is for every law or every rule or every standard, there's an outlaw, and it'd be one set of lawyers or another doing it. The easiest way to draw a dichotomy is by amount in dispute. If you're dealing with a dispute that is of whatever amount the parties determine, 100,000, 1 million, 5 million, whatever it might be, there to have very specific limitations is a lot more palatable. There's no reason you should be taking 20 depositions for a $500,000 dispute. So you could do that. But one of the things that's better than a drafting solution is a creative solution by the parties and the panel. When you know, having a standard, whether it's proportionality or a limit of such and such, unless there's good cause, but it just changes it changes the way you refer to the issue. It doesn't really change the result, because then 2 out of 3 panel members say there's good cause. Well, what is that and why is it? It all comes down really to the panel having a handle on what is actually in dispute, what are legitimate requests for information, and what are fishing expeditions or attempts to just make it rough on the other side. And you, to some extent, you're at the mercy of the professionalism of the parties and the lawyers to make their case. And if the panel members were to err on the side of just being a little skeptical on broad discovery requests and put the parties to the fire to at least say, here's what I'm looking for.
I think you've touched on it, but I think the biggest advantage that a judge has over we arbitrators is that that you go into a courtroom, the judge owns the process. He doesn't really care what the lawyers have agreed to. If the judge makes the rules, you play the game according to the way the judge wants the game played. We arbitrators are reluctant to tell counsel, who presumably are being overseen by their clients, which I think is a huge unwarranted presumption, that they walk in with an agreement. They walk in with a proposed scheduling order the first day at the organizational meeting. We can cajole, we can question, we can tease them, but it's very hard to say, you guys have agreed that this is what you need, but I know better than you, and I'm going to tell you what to do. I, for one, think we have the power to do that. we could tell them what to do, because once they've hired us, they've relinquished control to some extent. They don't quite fully own the process anymore. Problem is, it takes guts for the panel to do that, because the panel is worried that they're going to be overturned for not affording due process. I think that it's up to us as arbitrators to be a little bolder in our assertion of our powers and try to control the process from the beginning. And one thing that I haven't tried yet, but if I could just get enough cases to experiment with some of these things, I'd be happy. Is instead of asking the parties to agree to a scheduling order before they walk in to an organizational meeting, one thing that I've been thinking about trying is not to encourage them to agree to a scheduling order before they walk into the organizational meeting, but insist that the scheduling order be negotiated in front of the panel on the day of the organizational meeting, where the panel could actually get involved and listen to, you know, what they're going to say about discovery. That might be a way of trimming it back, rather than just telling the lawyers agree to something which is based largely on maximizing the hourly fees.
I think the parties pay their lawyers to exercise some control and some judgment, and not just go ahead, you won the $100,000 dispute, but it cost us $1.5 million. That's usually not a welcome result unless there's some overriding portfolio interest. And you know, most lawyers I suspect that you see have long-term relationships with their clients and are ethical and want to get the best cost-effective result for their clients. But I think when you see things that suggest to you that's not going on and the process is being abused, the parties will respect and welcome the intervention of the panel.
In my experience, when receiving statements of position, that lawyers from both sides say, and we want attorney's fees and costs, if both sides say, in writing, signed by the representative of both parties?
The answer is yes. It's pretty well established that if both parties, even if the arbitration provision says otherwise, if both parties request fees in the case, it's deemed an amendment that allows the panel to award attorney's fees. Now, if the clause is crystal clear that panel shall not award fees, what business the attorneys have requesting them, but the well-established practice is that, and this is under the AAA law, if both parties request fees in the arbitration, even if the contract is silent about them, the panel has the authority by virtue of that request, that joint request, to award them.
I just wanted to make a comment on discovery. A good way to set the tone and scope of discovery is at the point where you issue an agenda as the umpire or as the panel. And in that case, you can at least set the tone by suggesting how many depositions that you will allow, accept after application to the panel. And the other possibility is using 26B as a suggestion as to how to negotiate a scheduling order at the organizational meeting, or at least provide enough framework so that the lawyers can go back and negotiate their scheduling order and come back to the panel with one for their approval.
I'd like to ask a question about market evolution. If you go back to the last millennium, people were complaining about the size of arbitration and the amount of dispute. You still hear that. It's a strong trend. It continues. And the only way you can effectively change that is either increase the amount involved in arbitration by combining multiple contracts, so making the reinsurance contract bigger. And so my question is, do you anticipate that 5 to 10 years from now, we're going to see the shift in arbitration clauses moving to single arbitration panels for multiple contract disputes?
Well, once again, thanks to all of the very august arbitrators, intermediaries, umpires for not only coming here today, but offering your thoughts and participating in some very good and interesting back and forth on managing arbitrations, discovery, and some of those reoccurring issues that we're all confronted with. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us on Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We look forward to speaking to you soon on other topics of interest to insurance and reinsurance professionals, practitioners, and decision makers.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.